This is the beginning of Class 5.
Sasi Bhagi Jushin Eta Jan Viravin Shin Yende Yampadi Sange Shindu Mithe Uwahi Jogunanda Shiva
So what is the emptiness then if the wall gets broken down? The emptiness of
the wall no longer exists. When the wall is destroyed, there is no emptiness.
So how do you refer to that which is left?
Therefore, I don't like the word permanent. Because that's obviously not permanent, but it's not. So that's why I have trouble with that word. In the case of death meditation, when it's called Chiwa Nidakma, your impermanence, that's okay. That's a good translation. But in general, in Buddhist philosophy, I have trouble with that. It doesn't quite do it for me. So I like to call them unchanging and changing. Okay? Dakta means changing, and mitaka means unchanging. The emptiness of the wall will never change. So long as it exists, its quality never changes a width. Anyway, dakta means unchanging. The emptiness of the wall will never change. So long as it exists, its quality never changes a width. Anyway, never changes at all. It goes out of existence and comes into existence, but while it exists, it never changes. That's the idea. It has no cause. Nothing produces it. Nothing can affect it. Therefore, it's unchanging.
Tapa is unchanging.
You're right.
Mitapa is changing.
Changing. And even in Tibetan, they admit that they put the me on the wrong one. Okay? It's reversed. This one is negative. This one happens to be positive. It's just a quirk of Tibetan language that habit has a negative. The concept is positive. This concept is negative.
That explains the leaning towards permanent and impermanent, not permanent.
Right, because it sounds a little bit easier. But you can see now why it's technically wrong. Mm. The emptiness of the wall is not permanent, but it is unchanging. That's the point.
The
mind is changing, but eternal. And
teachers say permanent and then use changing and unchanging to qualify it. Say it's permanent, but this is permanent and changing. Well, this is permanent and unchanging.
Oh, yeah, in English you have to say that, but if you use permanent for this, then you can't, this never changes. There's no such thing.
Can you say permanent and changing and also permanent?
In English you can, but you can't say dhapa and changing and dhapa and unchanging. Dhapa means unchanging. Unproduced, unborn, undestroyable.
So that's mind. Mind is talk.
No, it's me.
But you just said that it's continuous.
It's eternal, but it's changing. By the way, functioning thing, anything which does something, is a synonym for mita. Anything which is produced is a synonym for mitapa. Anything which can be destroyed is a synonym for mitapa. Anything which is produced and destroyed by the instant is a synonym for mitapa. But you'll study that some other day. There's a whole book about it.
So then there's two kinds of emptiness. There's permanent emptiness and impermanent emptiness. The emptiness of a wall being impermanent emptiness.
The emptiness
of your mind is permanent.
The emptiness of your mind is eternal.
So there's two different kinds of emptiness.
In fact, that's your Buddha nature, since you brought it up. And I'm not, it's not the class. That's not the subject. It's not even the school. But the emptiness of your mind, since it will be around when you become a Buddha, is your Buddha nature. And what those other people all say is Buddha nature is completely wrong. It's not that you are Buddha inside and you didn't uncover it or something like that.
So that was my question, that when the wall breaks down, the emptiness is no longer there because it's a wall, whereas when a person dies, the emptiness is still there because it's a person or an animal or an insect,
right,
or whatever.
Right, the continuum, the emptiness of the continuum of the mind never goes out of existence.
But you could still call it the emptiness. Mind. I was just thinking maybe you're thinking of it as mind instead of emptiness. So it is still the emptiness of the mind continuing, whereas the
what is the emptiness of the mind? The emptiness of the mind is the fact that the mind does not have any nature of itself. No nature of itself. Not even of being mind of itself.
So what is mind?
Self-sinripa. That which is aware and
that
was clear and aware. What? Clear and aware. Aware and knowing.
So is that light consciousness?
Same definition.
So talking about the emptiness of the wall, when the wall is destroyed and changed.
When the wall is destroyed, there's no longer any fact that the wall has no nature.
Yeah, maybe a way to think of it in terms of its dependent origination, because it's a wall dependent upon our conceiving of it and labeling it as a wall.
Yes,
so it gets
broken
down. We no longer conceive of it and label it as a wall. Therefore, it's no longer be a wall.
There's no heap of parts to be labeled as a wall. That's one thing.
Therefore, we now perceive it and label it rubble, and it has emptiness of rubble, which is dependent upon our perceiving it that way.
I have a question with a little step back. And it might be a little bit blasphemous. Would it be better for us to learn this in English? Would it be clearer to learn this in English so not to have confusion of takpa mi takpa?
Maybe in this particular case, but in general it's good to
wait, ultimately?
A seat in your mouth. It's good to have a bhakti. It's good for you to hear the Tibetan. Why do they always put Sanskrit at the beginning of a Tibetan book? I mean, in the Kangyur and Tengyur. They always put the Sanskrit. Nobody knows what it means. They religiously put the Sanskrit. One reason is that the holy... I mean, the first Dalai Lama and his commentary on the Dharma culture says, because when you become a Buddha, you will speak Sanskrit. I mean, there's a reason to put stuff in that you don't think of. It's to put an imprint in your consciousness, and it will come out later. Tonight we're going to discuss the idea of omniscience. Okay, what is the nature of omniscience? Omniscience is a state of mind, a kind of mental state, and it's obviously tied into tema because omniscience is tema or pramana or correct perception towards everything, and only a Buddha has that. That's why he's a person of total accuracy, tema kyu. So we have to discuss what is omniscience, and the reason it's coming up here, and the reason I'm talking about it is, there was a school in ancient India called the Charvaka, and they said that there isn't such a thing as omniscience. They agreed to that. But they said an omniscient being can only be the creator of the world. They said omniscience always comes along with being creator of the world. You can't be omniscient without being the creator of the world. They said those two qualities have to come together.
And they use the same word, I mean, it's directly translatable to omniscience?
Yeah.
Opposed to omniscience.
Exactly the same word as the Buddhists use.
Same definition.
Same definition. Knowing all things in all times. But they said that that being who knew all things and who must have made the world is also Dhatma, which is what?
Unchanging.
He never changes. From him flow all things. He knows the smallest sparrow's pain. He made this world. And he's stuck. Unchanging. Which means he's always been that way. He's always been omniscient. So his qualities are like that. They, you know, if you are sitting in Tibet and trying to grasp this idea, it's a little bit weird. You know, they say, okay, there's this guy who made the world, and he also knows all things. And those two qualities always come together, and he never changes. So Tibetans, you know, said, actually it was Dharmakirti, said, well, let's examine this idea. Let's examine if such a thing is possible. So where do you put mind in these two? Mind. Mind is changing all the time. Mind is changing by the minute.
Yeah. This came up last week when we were talking about the Buddha's omniscience. And if the Buddha knows all things from all time, then isn't there a sense in which the time is unchanging in a way that he says it's the same, but he's continuing on?
The Buddhist school, there were schools in Tibet that thought that. There were schools in Tibet that argued that the Buddha must, his omniscience must be done.
No.
It's mitakta, it's changing. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you Dharmakirti's argument. Okay. And when Dharmakirti gets, when Geshe Wangshu gets through presenting Dharmakirti's idea, he says, and that should be enough for all these Tibetans who think that the omniscience of the Buddha is unchanged. If you don't believe Dharmakirti, how can I do? Dharmakirti is answering that question. Dharmakirti is, I'm about to explain Dharmakirti's explanation of why even the Buddhas might have to be changed. And the fact is that the mind has something like five qualities. And one of them is called namba. Namba means when you look at an object, your mind takes on that aspect. when you look at blue, your mind gets a little blue. What do I mean? It means like a mirror gets a little blue. If you put a blue object in front of a mirror, it's not like it stains the mirror and there's blue in the mirror forever, you know, forever after. But there is some kind of blueness reflecting in the mirror. The object, some quality of the object exists in the mirror at that time. The mirror is mirroring that blueness. The mirror has some blueness in it for the time that the blue is in front of the mirror. And then when you take the blue away from the mirror, what happens? The blueness goes away. It's not like a computer burn. What do you call it? Burning? Burnout?
Burns in screen on a computer.
It's not like that. There's no shadow stays there. And the mind is the same. Whenever you put an object in front of the mind is like a mirror. The mind is like a piece of glass. And when you put the blueness behind the glass, then the glass takes on some quality of blue. And when you remove the blue, the mind loses that quality.
And in this sense, it seems to me that there's some self-existent blueness that's not appearing before the mind.
Why self-existent?
Well, where's the blueness coming from? It's just because the condition presented itself to the mind.
We'll study the mind-only school's presentation someday. And they say that the seed, which creates the blue, and the seed, which creates the mind seeing the blue, there's a karmic seed that's triggering both of them.
So the seed is already within the mind? So what this the mind is taking on what it already is received for?
The fact that the mind changes to blue when the blue is presented to the mind, and the fact that the blue was presented to the mind are all coming from the same karmic seed. And that's a beautiful thing to learn, but it's not the it will go over.
Now, I'm getting confused because you keep jumping from one school to the other and I'm getting really confused.
When an object appears before the mind, one of the qualities of the mind is that it reflects that object. It takes on the image of that object. And you know that. It's not that color leaks into the mind, but it's in the way that color is reflected in a mirror. Somehow the mind is soaked with that object. Somehow that object is imaged in the mind, and when you take the object away, it goes away. That image in your mind goes away. That's called nama. NAMPA. It's one of the five qualities of it. By the way, there are schools in Tibet that think if you figure out how the number works, you perceive emptiness. And they spend many years meditating on the mind and how it takes on the form of an object. They call that meditating on the. They think that's meditating on the ultimate nature of the mind. And it's wrong. That's not the ultimate nature. Just the normal nature of the mind. No big deal. You can see it pretty easily. But what I'm saying is it takes some practice to, you know, just cook it. Your mind is like a mirror. What's presented in front of the mind somehow reflects in the mind. And that's called nama. The mind takes on that aspect. Now, if the object is changing, what happens to the mind? It changes. It's like a mirror. When you move the object out of the mirror, the object is moving across the mirror, and the reflection of the mirror is changing. Part of the mirror is changing. What I'm trying to say is, if a state of mind focuses on something which is changing, then the mind itself must change.
But couldn't there be, something like a river? I mean, a river is continually changing, but it's continually the river.
Yeah, the mind is just like that. The mind is eternal, but not unchanging. It's always changing.
But the vessel is not changing. The ingredients are changing.
Yeah, and that is what it is for the vessel to change.
Hmm? What's in the vessel is changing, but the vessel is not changing.
Is the mirror changing?
Mm. The mirror is always a mirror. It just is reflecting.
Yeah, so the mirror is changing.
But it's always a mirror.
Yeah, and the mind is always the mind. The fact that it's a mind doesn't change. The mind is changing. The fact that it's a mind doesn't change. Sam Yimba, that's a famous debate for kids in the monastery. You know, 15-year-olds in the monastery spend hours. They love the action. They don't really think much about what they're doing. They say, they debate about whether the fact that the mind is permanent or not. It's unchanging or not. That's unchanging. The mind will always be the mind. Or the fact that the mind is named the mind is always unchanging. But the, what The mind itself is changing in the way the mirror is changing. If you perceive what? If you are looking at what? A changing thing. If you're focused on a changing thing, then your mind is your sensation is changing. The colors are changing, the shapes are changing, thoughts are changing.
So when you perceive emptiness, it is not changing anymore?
Ah, now that's my next point. Did everybody get the first point?
To go with what Robin said, since the Buddha is seeing everything, the past, present, and future, at every moment, it's the same set which he's seeing constantly.
But those objects are changing.
Not from moment to moment, because it's the same set he's seeing from moment to moment.
Does he perceive the flow of time?
No, that's a very interesting point, because it shows the way that we tend to ascribe static ontology to things, even if we say, okay, if I have a whole history of something from its life to birth, if I can see it at each moment, it still must have some kind of substance that subsists. But it's actually that it has nothing like that, so that even if you can see the totality of its moments, those slices of time themselves are always in the midst of change. There's really nothing to hold on to.
You can say that. You can say that. But anyway, the object, if the objects are changing, the mind is changing, even the Buddha's mind. How does the Buddha see change?
I guess my point is that because he's perceived everything,
and is perceiving everything all the time,
his perception hasn't changed.
His perception doesn't change, but yeah. But does he see change?
He does see change,
then his mind changes. Think about it, just cook it. Okay. This is Dhammakirti, it's not Michael Rose. Okay. And the verses in your reading, and the commentaries in your reading. And be aware that some Buddhist schools in Tibet later thought just that. They thought omniscience was not wisdom. They thought it never changed. But every book in India, every Buddhist book says the mind changes. The mind isn't changing all the time.
Why would they say not wisdom? What do they mean by wisdom? It's not.
They think. They. I guess what they mean is they can't accept that omniscience is a state of wisdom. Because if they do, they have to accept that it's changing.
Why does wisdom have to be changing?
I don't know. But they avoid that. They don't want to say that the omniscience. Maybe because it's a mental function. Maybe they accept that mental functions change, but the main mind doesn't change. Maybe therefore they have to argue that the omniscience is not a mental function, but it's the main consciousness. All right, now what about, if what I said is true, and just cook it, you don't have to accept it. If what I said is true, then what about a mind perceiving an unchanging object? Is the mind then unchanging?
Well, what kind of an object could the mind perceive that was unchanging?
Emptiness?
So okay. So let's say an emptiness.
Or the fact that there's no elephant in this room. Mm.
Good.
It goes out of existence. Okay. No, the lack of an elephant in this room does not change from moment to moment until an elephant comes in. So let's say until 5 o'clock, no elephant comes in. During that time, the lack of an elephant never changes its quality in the slightest bit. It just does not, its quality doesn't shift in the slightest bit. Always exactly, purely lack of elephant. It doesn't get less or more lack of elephant. That's what changing means. So
but that's a background perception, right?
Yeah.
That would be, if you're sitting in this room, observe, you don't sit here. Until an elephant shows up, you don't sit here and the only thing you can see is that there's no elephant.
No, but whenever you focus on that object, you're focusing on an unchanging object. It never gets more or less elephant-less. It's just elephant-less.
So I can measure that.
But your convictions will change. I mean, it's
like... No, that's different. It's only different. That's it. That's it.
Hoping so then there's an empty.
Glad it's not here.
No, no,
that's
there.
Glad
enough.
Do we have to know the other qualities of the mind in order to answer that question?
They would confuse and it's a long question. So that's all. Now, what is the argument? Why does Dharmakirti say a mind is omniscience is changing? Just get that one. Why?
Things are always changing.
Because it's focusing on the thing.
No.
He's saying the mirror is changing if in front of the mirror there's something going like that. If something is moving in front of the mirror is changing too. That's his argument. Therefore, omniscience is
changing.
Because omniscience focuses on what?
Things that are changing. Everything.
Everything. Stop with that. By the way, this covers all existing objects. Every existing object has to be in one or the other.
So omniscience is
number? No. It has a number. Okay. Omniscience is, what is, omniscience, think of omniscience as a big mirror. What's reflecting in the mirror? Every single object in the universe that ever was, will, or...
And
it. Yeah. And there, and each of those objects is emptiness. It's seeing all of those things. Okay, it's all those things are reflecting the mirror. As long as there's anything moving, the mirror is changing. Omniscience is changing. Therefore, because omniscience sees all stuff, and because changing things are some one of those stuff, then the omniscience is changing. That's Dharmakirti's argument. Now the non-Buddhists come and say, well, what about when the mind focuses on something unchanging? According to you, then that mind, at that time, should be unchanging, right? Dharmakirti, no, not necessarily. He says it doesn't, in other words, the reverse is not necessarily true. If you focus on something unchanging, the mirror is changing. I'm sorry, focus on something changing, the mirror is changing.
Why?
But just because you focus on something unchanging doesn't mean the mirror is unchanging.
Why?
And he says because the mind engages in the object and then withdraws from the object. The mind is always like a fly. It's on the object for a while and then goes away. This is a tough one, isn't it? This is the argument. He doesn't mention that. Because he says, is the mind focused on the object? Is the mind like a, we call it bangu narshi. We say a person who can't sit in his seat is called a fly in Tibet. You know, he can't. He comes to the object and then he goes to the other one and then he comes back to the object. This is the nature of our minds, anyway. And there, that's called rengal. It means the mind is changing because sometimes it's engaged and sometimes it's not engaged. And that's changing.
Yeah, isn't that really the only change? I mean, this
when he's
not
focusing on something unchanging, that seems to be, I mean, that's Dharmakirti's argument for saying that even then the mind is changing.
So prior to omniscience, the mind is always changing.
No, but he's saying omniscience
he's saying
is changing.
He would say even omniscience is changing.
Because
omniscience is changing.
Right. I'm just making the distinction about the before period.
But when you look at the ninth stage of meditation and you reach the final stage of samatha, I thought by definition I thought your mind, by definition, your mind doesn't wander, so you're not withdrawing and engaging.
Well, I'll say this. At that point, let's say you're meditating on your thoughts. Or we need something unchanging, right? Let's say emptiness. Is emptiness at 4 o'clock the same as emptiness at 4:01?
Yeah.
Maybe.
when you're meditating on emptiness, you're meditating on a generality, on a concept, really, aren't you?
Not when it's right. But anyway,
because it's not.
So those are his two arguments. I'll go over them. He says omniscience must be changing because omniscience sees all things, and changing things are part of all things. So if the object is called blah, 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 then the perception of it must be somehow reflecting. Yeah.
But is there really an object that's going blah blah blah, or is it merely a perception of an object that's going blah blah blah?
In this school, the object.
Okay.
Now, why doesn't then why then Tim's question? Why then if something if the mind focuses on an unchanging object, don't you call the mind unchanging? Well, because it's touching the object and then it's engaging and then it's disengaging. And that's changing. That's his argument.
Well, that's so the direct perception of emptiness is.
Is a state of mind, and all mind is changing. I can give you another argument why mind is changing.
Isn't
mind
changing because it's consciousness from moment to moment?
That's another reason. But this is not his argument here. He's basing his argument on the nature of the object. But in fact, since mind has to be caused, of course it's changing all the time. Why? The energy that shoves it into our present time is always it's a reaction in. Anything that pushes something gets less as time goes on. The energy that keeps it going changes.
But second moment of omniscience is not caused by the Buddha.
It doesn't focus on its object by the power of the first moment of omniscience. So
it's not.
That's right.
Let's say this. Its direct cause is the omniscience of the moment before, and always will be and must be. It's material cause. The stuff that turns into omniscience of the second moment has to be the omniscience of the first moment.
But it's not triggered by...
What's giving it the content, what's creating the content is not the omniscience of the first moment. You have to distinguish between... There's five types of causes. The stuff that turns into the mind of the second moment, the stuff that turns into omniscience of the second moment is always the omniscience. It's always, that's why he says he has a mind stream. He still has a mind stream.
But is it...
Has to be.
But there has to be some stuff to turn into omniscience.
But then what does it mean to
think on this?
It's not the memory of the object of the first moment which is triggering the awareness, the consciousness. It's the very objects themselves.
Because they're always present.
Yeah. It's not like he looks at the blue and he turns away and he says, oh yeah, I remember what all things were like. He sees them again, pure, fresh.
So the Buddha has no memory?
No, he doesn't have the mental function of memory. He doesn't even have jipaksa. He doesn't have deduction.
And he doesn't have clairvoyance either.
Except insofar as he can read someone's mind. You know, he can perceive your deduction, so he knows deduction exists.
Right.
He doesn't require the state of deduction, because everything for him is evident.
So being without any memory. Any mental function of memory or clairvoyance.
Why not clairvoyance?
Well, what's the difference between clairvoyance and just seeing it directly?
We do call it clairvoyance, but we call it the Buddhist clairvoyance. We call it Sangyikitin. There's a word for it. Five eyes, first chapter of the Samaka. Yeah.
Okay, this is something that can't for me when I came to the homework. The Buddha, once he's enlightened, presumably because he sees everything, also sees his own semas and semins prior to enlightenment.
Oh, and that's
his own
why he wrote the Kanja. That's why he spoke the Kanja.
Right.
Kanja is 16 volumes of it.
But so there is this kind of
bad things to people.
But that's not, it's not really a self, I mean, would you call that a self?
It's not apperception. It's not apperception in the classic sense of apperception.
Okay, so it's
where
not
the mind perceives itself.
Introverted, right.
It's not that.
And the other thing is, you sounded like you were making a distinction about moments of consciousness from the first moment of omniscience to the next.
Yeah.
But you're acting as though it's beginning at omniscience. But doesn't it begin with... It's not. It's beginningless, because it's begun long before omniscience.
The mind stream is beginningless.
Right.
Omniscience, there's a moment that it begins to be a quality of that mind stream.
Right, but it doesn't. Does it completely transform that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Is it a complete
break?
Yeah,
no.
Break
still,
with, no.
No. That's why we talked about the Buddha nature. Sangye is the Gyurung definition of Buddha nature. Sangye Kivik. Anything that turns into the Buddha. One more, and then we gotta go on, because I'm gonna.
Okay.
I feel bad.
Are there any other metaphors for the mind other than mirror, because mirror is way off. I mean,
well, they say glass.
But it would be glass that has an on-off switch. Like when a mirror is...
Never empty. It never
emptiness.
Has no off-switch.
When it's perceiving emptiness.
That's a definite object. That's a very important. See, then you got a wrong idea of emptiness, and you should have been in the first class.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, the mind never turns off. We wish, right?
All mind, the Buddha mind, or
mind is never without an object. There is a state called the Dushimekhin, you know, mindless. There is a very deep state of meditation which is called non-mind or something, but it's not really. Okay. So those are his two arguments for. And I present it to you, and maybe I leave it like this. You know, I.
Those were his two arguments?
There were
two. Did he just say those were his two arguments?
Yeah, one
of the two. That would be the first two questions I'm going to ask. Why does Dharma clearly think that omniscience has to be changed? Why?
Because it's focusing on
changing things. Why is it focused on changing things?
It doesn't
oriented.
It focuses on everything, and everything has a lot of changing things. In fact, unchanging things are quite rare. The quantities are much less. You should talk. Well, what about it? Doesn't everything have an emptiness? Yeah, I guess. Okay. Abhidharma says there then. Okay, then he says, then somebody says, well, Bhavakiri, I guess mind is unchanging too, because mind focuses on unchanging things. And he says, well, not necessarily so. Why?
Because the mind engagement.
Yeah, he steps back from that argument about content of the mind. You know, well, that's for unchanging. That's for changing stuff. Unchanging stuff, because the mind focuses on it and then goes away and then comes back again, well, then it's changing. The mind is changing.
Yeah, but it's your omniscient, and you're seeing everything all the time.
Maybe in the second moment, it's, maybe it's disengaging from being in there. Alright, now he asks, I gotta write another one.
Jiten,
it's a beautiful word in Tibetan. It's the name for the world. It's the word for the world. The dirty world. Our suffering world. It's not a synonym for samsara, but it's the name in Tibetan for the place. The world. Jig means destructible. Ten means basis. And, you know, it just means world. Soapo means maker of the world, creator. And this school, the Charvakas, they said that there was this person. And other schools in Hinduism said there was a force that created the world. And that force, that primal cause, and that Jiten Soapo, who they call Ishvara, okay, or Indra, is unchanging. He's unchanging, but he creates the world. He's been forever, and then at some point he creates the world.
Michael, who believes this? Is this a Hindu?
It's called Charvaka. It's a school which was prevalent in India in the coming of India. No, they're being. They were the believers in that being. And then the Samkhyas believed in this force. But I tell you something very serious. You know, this subject is not just religious debate. You know, it's not just an interesting question. You know what I mean? You have in your guts, and I have in my guts, some gut feeling that, well, what your parents said was true. You actually entertain the thought. You actually seriously consider the thought that there's a being who makes the world, and that there is an outside force who is either cares about us or doesn't care about us, who's watching us, who's somehow involved with our lives. And you, in your guts, you have a little bit of that left. Different degrees, I would guess. You know, but you probably. You know, you can't pick up a magazine or a newspaper, or you can't read a novel, or it's always there. There's always this idea of a being who made the world and who has some influence on your life. And if you think about these arguments carefully, that's just a totally wrong idea. That's just illogical. It just doesn't mean, it doesn't, it's just false. It's just non-existent. And so why pick on people's beliefs, you know? It's kind of nice to think to someone there. Because you have to find out what really made the world. That's the point. It's not to pick on you know, whatever tradition you grew up with and I grew up with. It's that we were inculcated, it didn't grow in us when we were born. It was taught to us. And if it's wrong, and if there's a different place where the world came from, and where our experiences come from, and where our suffering comes from, then this is a very bad idea. This is very harmful to us. It blocks us. It obstructs our getting out of suffering. And insofar as you entertain this idea, then you have a very dangerous block to getting out of suffering. So it's not just a useless debate, you know. And you have to think about it. It matters where the world came from. And it matters who made the car accident and the cancer and and these nice sunsets and the flowers, it really does matter if you want to get out of suffering. It's a very vital, important question. It's not just, they're wrong, we're right, like that. That doesn't help anybody. I've been waiting for someone to ask that. Okay, anyway, we gotta show how we will show one small problem with the idea that an unchanging being creates the world. Okay, she asked a very good question. Did you make it in 7 days? If you think about it, why shouldn't this creator, if his nature is never to change, why does he take history to make the world? Why does he take millions of years to make the world? Why can't he do it in 7 days? Why did the world develop? Why does the world go on? Why does it take so long? Why does time go on? Why does our life last for 50, 60, 70 years? Why? He can make it all and wipe it all out in a minute. Why not? Why is he restrained to years?
I thought we established that time was not a factor in this realm that we're discussing.
Well,
there
if
is
he's
no
unchanging,
time.
And if he's all-powerful, then why go through time? Why not destroy it? Create every being and every experience and every moment in history in the same moment, and then just be done with it. Why do things go on? Why do things have to change? Why does Lincoln have to come, and before that Washington, and after that Roosevelt? Why? Why can't he just do everything at one moment and get it over with? He's not restrained by time. He's starfucked. He can do it if he wants. Why do things go on? No, there's no logical reason. If he's totally powerful, and he can create all things and all, and he can create all moments of all things at the same time, so just do it. Why stretch it out? Why have
well, maybe
things
it
happen?
Did. Maybe we just perceive it that way.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah,
why do you
exactly.
make it perceive it? Well, now we call a rabbit's horn. And maybe it's 12 inches and maybe 14 inches. I don't know. We say in the monastery, okay, let's debate whether the rabbit's horn is 12 inches or 14 inches. Doesn't exist. Okay. Rinpoche means in stages. Rinpoche means in stages. The world, according to your own perception, occurs in steps, in stages.
Rinpoche stages.
That's where the word lamrim comes from, right? Rin means a step. Shin means in. Rinpoche means in stages. That's the Buddhist proof why an unchanging being didn't create the world. Because things are happening in steps. And things must happen in steps. You create the causes, you nurture a thing, you cultivate a thing, and then over a period of time the thing grows. And that's the way things work. And anything else is mula nidre, we had it last week. Anything else is an insult to your perception. You can see that's the way things work. You have to do your work at work, you have to open the bank account, you have to get the materials ready, you have to hire the staff, and then after a few months you can produce something, but it just doesn't happen like that. Things are closed. Yeah.
Could you also say that if this was an unchanging being, the act of creating something would be changed?
That in itself is a contradiction, total contradiction. Anything which expends energy to do something is changing. Must be changing.
But there's some people I guess that say primal cause. That God was that in other words, he started the ball rolling and then he said, okay, take it. Let it go.
To a Buddhist who never heard about this primitive idea, mm-hmm. he'd say, you're just grabbing at straws. What are you talking about? Why? If he's omnipotent. By the way, a Buddha is what? He's omniscient, but he sure isn't omnipotent. If he was omnipotent, what?
No suffering.
No cancer. Come on. No AIDS. No pain. What is he? A Buddhist? Does he want to test you? Okay, test me and finish the test within 1 second.
Unchanging thing cannot mean that change
something,
is that it?
Impossible.
So why couldn't you say this is a change?
You have to expend energy to do something. You have to move to change. You have to move to make something.
So why couldn't you say this being was a permanent changing of this being?
They didn't say that. Well, we're not fighting somebody who said that.
Well, what they did.
but the implication is when they say he...
We'd have to think about it. And by the way, there's hundreds of pages. I mean, they go through all the Hindu schools, but this is the one that to me was most interesting. Because I grew up, when I was in the monastery debating it, I realized I was the best debater to defend this position. And then I realized that's my problem. Yeah.
Well, the Judeo-Christian appeal is that God is jealous, he gets wrathful, so they claim that he's changing. He's omnipotent, but he changes. They never claim that he doesn't change because he's always responding and punishing us and everything else.
Yeah.
They never say he hasn't changed.
Right. But they say he was God for all time. Which brings me to the next part. In other words, I'll give you Dharmakirti's, now, then I'll finish and we'll take a break. Dharmakirti's argument against that. Now he has to say, he'll say to you, okay, you change now. Now you say your God changes. Now you say your God goes through moods, and sometimes he does stuff, sometimes he doesn't do stuff. So he changes. But you say that his quality was godness forever. He never was not God, and then he did something to become God. He's always been God. And then Dharmakirti says, that in itself is a wrong idea. He says, that's not possible. That you have to go through, there has to be some cause to make you omniscient.
Omniscient or omniscient?
Well, how can we can accept that the mind stream has no beginning? Where is the cause for the mind stream thing?
We'll talk about it. We're going to get there in the seventh class. Okay. But this is Dharmakirti. He says, and you know, to us it sounds not very good argument. But I'll present it to you and you think about it. He says, a being who has been perfect for all time, a being who has been omniscient and omnipotent for all time, have never suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. He almost says it that way. You know? I mean, he's never had anything bad happen to him, and he's never had anything good happen to him. In a previous version of himself, which was suffering, he never has. He's never been through that. So, and then Dharmakirti says, therefore he cannot be omniscient. That was cooking. He could not have applied the antidote to suffering and therefore become omniscient. A person who's been Mr. Know-it-all forever, never had a time when he became Mr. Know-it-all because he never suffered. And because he never suffered, he never practiced the practices that allow you to stop suffering. What's the main one? Direct perception of emptiness. He never went through that. He never did that. He never was a wimp long ago and had bad things happen to him and then learned the way, learned the path, meditated on emptiness directly, and with that powerful antidote, stopped his suffering. He never did that. Therefore, he's not omniscient, and he doesn't exist.
Yeah,
this is
a kind of a tautology.
It is a tautology.
I mean, so how can we be persuaded by that?
Cook it. All I say is cook it. Some of these things are so out of our... What he's saying is that, what is he saying when he says that? It can only be a good argument if it's true that everybody in the world knows, come on, to become omniscient, you must go through suffering. And you must perceive emptiness directly. Right? I mean, if we all knew that.
If we use that as a basis, then
yes. Yeah, if a priori that. So for him, somehow it's a priori. That's all. That's all I can say.
You don't have to burn yourself to know that fire burns.
Right. that's his argument, so I give you his argument. And I just say cook it. When we get back, we'll talk about where Buddhist thinking goes. And by the way, it's not like you don't believe me right now, so you'll never believe me. As you learn more, it will feed this. It will feed it more and more, and it will support it more and more. And then one day you'll say, oh, that's where the world came from. This is where my world came from. You must understand that to practice the higher teachings. these secret teachings. The whole idea of the secret teachings depends on understanding where the world comes from. If you practice these secret teachings without understanding these points, it's useless.
This omission of the did suffer.
Yeah.
Then he could be
omniscient. Or that he hasn't been omniscient forever. And
why can he suffer as omniscient as omniscient?
If he's omniscient, he's sticking pins in his eye. I don't know why he wants to do it.
Maybe
it's like my name.
Manja.
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 Manja. Manja. Manja means things you should take up. Things you should take up. Meaning things you should practice, things you should follow. And that's manja, things you should take up. Dorja means things you should give up. Things you should get rid of.
Which one?
Dorja.
Dorja. Dorja means things you should get rid of. Things you should abandon. If you knew this, if you knew where this line was, your life would be very good. You know? We got it mixed up. Some of the things that we should reject, like fame, money, attention of other people, hope for lasting love in this life, you know, things which are impossible. We are struggling to get those things. Those are not long chas, those are door chas. Things to get rid of. And then the long jas, which are, you know, sacrificing ourselves to help other people. You know, putting other people before us. You know, all those things, they're in our dorja part. But they should be long jas, you know. No, we don't know long jas and dorja very well. We don't know it. We've heard it, but we don't really believe it. We didn't buy into it. There's only one being who knows these conditions perfectly.
Buddha.
And that's Buddha. Okay. He knows it perfectly. And that, Dharmakirti says, is why he's omniscient. Dharmakirti has this long verse, which is in your reading. He says, it ain't omniscience to know every rock at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. It's not omniscience to know every bug crawling on every plant in the planet. Because omniscience, what really makes the Buddha omniscient, that he knows perfectly what we should be giving up and what we should be doing. And he's the only being. And that qualifies him as omniscient. And he says, if you think omniscience means some being who knows perfectly what we should be giving up and what we should be taking up, and think about it.
So then, according to Dharmakirti, the highest quality of omniscience, or the main thing of omniscience, or the most important thing of omniscience is this.
This is what qualifies you as omniscient. If you knew this perfectly, you'd be omniscient. He doesn't care if you can see everything in the world. And he has this beautiful line, which is very famous in Sorsho Jagat Tenbosho, which means, if you think knowing everything, or being able to see, you know, the atoms of some object, and basically that science is, that's what science is offering, right? They're offering you the ability eventually to see every object. He says, so big deal, it doesn't help you. It doesn't help you at all. That's not omniscience. That's not the point. So he says, if you think that's the omniscience, then go study with an eagle. Because if you've ever been in India, it's incredible. They have lots of eagles around their monastery. And vultures, what do you call them?
Vultures.
And they fly, you can barely see them. They're up about, I guess they would be a mile high or a mile and a half high or something. You can barely, you see them go up in a funnel, and then they disappear. You know they're up there. And then suddenly they swoop down, you know, like 3,000-4,000 feet and catch a mouse. You know, they got some kind of weird ability to see. You know, so in India in 600 AD, this was an example of some creature who could see unbelievable detail. So he says, if you think that's omniscience, then go study with
Christ. But does an omniscient person know all? I mean, I know that's not.
Yeah, he does also know all things. but that's not the main. That's not really the important reason. That's not the important part of being omniscient.
Is this important because it's tied to seeing the subtle aspect of karma, basically?
It helps. It helps. But basically, it's important because that's what helps us. That's our interest in the Buddha. Otherwise, the Buddha's not interesting. It's okay, somebody can see everything. Who cares? You know, if he can't get me out of this lousy life where everything I get is I lose, and I can't get all the things I want anyway, then I don't care. I don't care if this guy can see everything. You know, I don't care about Stephen Hawking wrote a book about the nature of the Big Bang. It just doesn't affect me.
So this is really the culmination. So seeing these two things is the culmination of seeing self karma.
Not directly related like that. But it helps. Of course, he had to know that to know this person. So,
Michael,
yeah.
It seems to me this is something that you have to accomplish as a prerequisite to developing omniscience.
Yeah, if you were omniscient, by the way, you would also know that. That's not the
case. No.
It's part of the process.
You've got to know it very well to become omniscient.
You know it better and better and better and better,
yeah,
and finally you know it
but
well.
You don't know it perfectly until the day you become omniscient. This is, by the way, called the pure side of existence. And this is called, I'll write it.
Pure side of
existence. Everything in the universe comes into one of those. And we don't know. We got it messed up. Shantideva says, you know, we chase after the things that hurt us and we run away from the things that would help make us happy.
The problem is when you try to give up the things that hurt you, it hurts.
Yeah. Okay, so that's your side of it. But by the way, if you do it with understanding, it's quite pleasant. You know, keeping your vows is a pleasure. You know, acting right is a pleasure. You know, helping other people. I mean, once you get into it, it's a real pleasure. There's no problem with it. It's like, you know, you think eating chocolate all day is happiness, and then when you stop, it feels really great. Anyway, pure side and afflicted side. What does affliction mean? Mental affliction. I call it bad thoughts. Sanskrit klesha. And affliction means the klish, the word comes from a Sanskrit root that means to bother you. And your mental, your six main afflictions bother you. Jealousy, anger, hatred, desire. These things bother you. They upset your mind. They afflict you. They irritate you all day long. If you didn't have them, it would be quite pleasant. That's the afflicted side. Afflicted side means things directly involved with those, or the products of those thoughts, which are what? New York City. Well, the karma, New York City is created by this. Affliction, by mental affliction. Your body and your mind. Your body and your mind were created by that.
Our experience in New York City is
your body and your mind are also torture. Right now. Your present state of your mind and your body are. They came from mental affliction. They were produced by mental affliction. And until you see emptiness, you'll continue. You'll continue to have all those emotions that you have on there, bad emotions.
You
want to
play with the
six? I was afraid to advance the pride.
Anger. Jealousy.
Greed.
Six main bad
thoughts. Jealousy.
You got them all?
Greed. Yes.
Sloth.
Ignorance is in there too.
Oh, wait, then I have seven.
Okay, I
got
to move
or else
this lady's running away on me.
80,000
bucks? Oh, which we didn't really mention.
80,000, yeah.
You want to do all of them, we got to do all of them.
Okay.
Just to remember them?
That's like 84,000 bad actions. Say Dukun?
Dukun.
One and two, okay? Duk is the first noble truth. I'm teaching you the shortest way to say it. Bring out that block. Sometimes in the monastery you say Duke. Duke is what? First noble truth is what?
Suffering. The truth of suffering.
The Buddha said all changing things are suffering. A little tricky. Most of our life is that. Bring out that block. Why is it a noble truth?
because it leads to
because it's a bad translation of Arya truth. What's an Arya truth?
What you see right before, by analysis, individual analysis, before you perceive Shinya.
Right after you see emptiness directly and become thereby an Arya, which has nothing to do with the race of people that attacked India in 1000 BC. Okay. You become an Arya. And then when you come out of that state, you perceive these four conditions totally. Directly, and you know that everything in your life is fine. Until that, you're not. It doesn't really. You don't see it directly. Because that's dukkha. Kun is what second Arya truth. Yeah, the source of suffering. Where does it come from? Kun stands for kunjung jamba, the source of suffering, which is mainly your bad thoughts, which are caused by ignorance. Why? The blank at work. You know, work is where it's at, you know. Where is your world? You know, where else are you going to learn all this stuff? Like the bad guy at work, when you react to him with ignorance, not realizing that he's empty and that he's a projection of your former past.
He's being pretty nice to me.
He's very nice, actually. That's not the boss that I always talk about.
That's not the big boss.
That's the big boss. He's actually quite nice.
And he's nice too, the big one.
Dukkun. So, kun means kunjung jamba, which means source of your suffering. And that's that whole mechanism that we keep talking about at work. You know, when you respond badly, that's kunjung jamba. It's source. It's creating more of the same. You gotta meet him again. That's exactly kunjung jamba. You're not gonna find some philosophical kunjung jamba somewhere else. That's it. As long as you have a bad day at work still, then you didn't make it, okay?
Sorry, my mind is going in and out.
Is it Dukkha
suffering? Excuse
me? Dukkha suffering? Dukkha suffering, which is first noble truth, and Kun is the origin. There's two ways to number them, but I won't remember.
Okay. But the two words together mean something. I mean, Dukkun means
something. It's a way in monastic debate to say the first two noble truths in a very easy way. We just say,
okay, so it represents the first two.
Okay. You don't want to learn all that. Suffering and the source of suffering. Both means what? Yeah, both jama means stopping it, finishing it, ending it. What they call cessation. Stopping it. Stopping suffering. That's gok. Gok means stopping suffering. And it really is, and you can really get it, and that's the whole point. I hope we do it before we die. I hope we do it before we all get old in these classes stuff. You know, that's our goal. We have to do it. You can do it. You can really do it. And it's quite pleasant. Okay. Love means path. Path is exactly, what's the main thing of path? Understanding the emptiness of that love. And then responding to it with compassion and morality. Well, the Buddha knows this condition perfectly. Last point is tonight. The homework question says, why is the Buddha unerring? Why is the Buddha never, why is he unerring? Why is he nilua? Why is he perfectly correct? Why does he never make a mistake? How can you know it? Yeah. On what basis can you say that the Buddha is correct when he describes these four? And he said, here's your condition, you're in trouble. You're getting old minute by minute. If you're pretty, you're getting ugly. If you're smart, you're going to be senile. It must happen. Anything you have, you will lose. You'll lose your body, your face, and your name. Forget about your kids and your friends and your money. Lose them. You lose your identity. Why should we believe him? This is a very important. Why should we take it?
Well, we see that it's true. Everybody does.
That's the nice. Okay, that's the real nice point. We see this one. Out of everything he said, out of everything the Buddha said, and by the way, this is one of the only proofs for believing the Buddha. Okay, it's one of the only good reasons you should be a Buddhist. It's one of the only good reasons why you should ever practice or go to a class. Is that he's the only being, I know in my experience, and maybe I don't know about you, who describes this condition perfectly. You know, out of those four, there's only one that I can perceive now. But he hit it on the nail. I love his description of stuff. I mean, that's what attracted me to Buddhism. It's so perfect. Nobody ever said anything like that, in my experience. You know, people are saying, things are all right, you know. Some things are okay, you know. You're kind of saying it kind of desperately, you know. just his description of the problem attracted me. This is absolutely true. The seed of the destruction of things starts as it begins. And my condition is unhappiness. And even those things which I dearly want to go right collapse. Why? What's causing this? What's going on? And does everybody suffer? You know, can somebody collect a certain amount of money, or can somebody reach a certain level of income, or can somebody reach a certain level of balancing their life that everything's all right and there's actually happy people in the world? No, not really. That's true. Like you kind of wish there were, and you kind of think that if you had a little more exercise, or you kind of think if I could just shift this over here and increase this, I really would be happy. But that's not the thing. It doesn't work. It never will. There is no balance like that. There's no such thing.
Doesn't that point to the fact that we really don't even see clearly the first one? We see the first one, but ultimately...
All I'm saying is that, and I love it, I heard Kedrujic, I've read it in Kedrujic. Why believe the Buddha? Because he describes that condition perfectly. And then, does that mean everything he said about stopping it is true? No. Does it mean I can take him as the closest thing to authority in my life that I've found? Yes. That's all. The rest is kind of an assumption. You know, you're taking his word for the rest because he described the problem so well. That's it. That's all. That's why he's supposed to be in there. That's the only way you'll ever see it. And for me, that's quite nice. For me, it's enough. And I don't actually have no choice. No one else even described the problem. But one guy described the problem. Okay, there's really nobody else. You know? That's the elimination one. Okay, I'm going to write one little quotation from the Abhidharma question. You guys have been dying to study Abhidharma, I know.
Michael, this is not the explanation, the Buddhist explanation of
what?
Cosmology. This is not the Buddhist explanation of where the world comes from, or are you...
This is the Buddhist explanation accepted by all schools.
So it's...
He's going to write it now.
You asked where the world came from, I'm going to tell you
right
now. Not your homework, it's not on your quiz. It is in your future life. And it's a great quotation from the fourth chapter of Kapha. And it's really these are two different words that are spelled the same and sound the same. The first one means karma. Le means karma. The second le means from. From. Jikten you had before, it means the world, or this planet. Lapsok means all the various ones, all the various ones. And Gye means come.
Come?
Come. So what's that sentence mean?
All the various worlds come from karma.
Yeah, all the planets of the universe come from karma. All these many planets that beings live on, according to Buddhism. Many, many planets with inhabited by beings like us. All of those planets come from karma. And this planet came from karma. Lele, Jikten, Lap, okay. Say, Lele, good luck.
Lele,
Jikten,
okay.
Deni means that, meaning that karma. And that karma Semba. Semba means when the mind moves. Anytime the mind moves. Anytime the mind goes like this, look. That's Semba. Movement of the mind. Shifting of the mind. What do you call it? There's a good word in English.
Think.
Yeah, thank you.
Vacillation.
It just means anytime it shifts. Shifts. Slightest movement of the mind. Semba. It's not the word sem, by the way. It doesn't mean mind. It's sempa. It's a different function of the mind. Anytime the mind moves. Dan means end. Jay Che means what it makes you do. Jay Che means what it makes you do. Or say. And that comes in the next line. The definition of karma is any time the mind moves. And anything inspired by that movement of the mind.
Anytime the mind moves?
Anytime the mind shifts, that's karma. That's
it. Is karma, and that creates the world.
Yeah.
Whose mind?
Yours. No, your own. That's a good question. You created this world. You created your world. We happen to, in this room, we have all done a karma together in the past that we are all experiencing the same room right now.
But that, is that mind only? I mean, that sounds...
No, it's accepted by all schools.
But then, is there a universe out there? Is there a universe out there separate from mind? Is there a mind out there separate from being?
Buddha, if you want to say that, but no, that's all. Every mind is a long spaghetti noodle that goes back with no beginning, goes on for no end, and they're all separate.
There's no universal mind.
They can be together, they can be near each other, but they can never mix.
So all these many, many minds create many, many worlds?
Then it's not
one world.
All the beings in this world have collected a similar karma to live in this world. And the people in Tijuana, who live 5 minutes from the people in San Diego, you know, have collected a different karma. They live in the same land, the same water, the same air, and they're very poor. And then 5 minutes across an imaginary line, everyone's extremely comfortable. And that's nice. But they've all created a karma to perceive the world.
Michael, just one quick. Are the number of those continuous minds finite or infinite?
Yeah.
They're finite.
It will never change. How's that?
Whatever it is.
That's not an answer.
Do they not address that, or is it a big deity, or did you... Right. Okay.
Sentient beings are terrible.
Right.
There will be a day when the last sentient being becomes.
Can we be more than one sentient being at a time?
Mm-hmm.
Can we be more than one sentient being at a time?
No.
No?
Never. Never. That's an absolute principle. You cannot collect karma for someone else. You cannot experience someone else's karma.
No. Can I, my mind, be an insect in hell and here at the same time?
Can a mind split in half?
You can perceive hell in this realm if you have certain
eight. And our mind will always stay as one mind continuum.
Yeah,
we'll never grow.
All the people
who
have ever become Buddhas are different beings.
Can you say the whole statement?
The various worlds of the universe come from karma. Karma is the movement of the mind and what it inspires us to say or do or say. Karma is any movement of the mind. And what that inspires us to do or say. And it's accepted by all schools, but not every school understands how our emptiness ties into this, how perceptions tie into this. And you must study those. Otherwise, karma is not very easy to swallow. When you study that in detail, you'll be able to buy it quite easily. And that's a good subject for our next class.
So this New Age concept of as you think, so becomes your reality, and your reality is truth, not in the sense that they consider it.
But there's always a time lag with you.
What is the time
lag? You don't believe in causelessness. Hmm. If you are good now, if you are moral now, I'm sorry to say it won't help you. And that's the problem that people have. Udayana, Kibudayana, and King Udayana
you became an arhat, and you...
Yes.
And Buddhism doesn't promise you that. Buddhism says you've got certain causes in action and emotions. You can remove them through proper purification. But don't expect not to have major problems in your life. That's not the way it works. Sorry. But that, it's cause and effect. If you don't get the effect, at the same time it's the cause. It's impossible. It will improve. Your life will improve. But you know, accidents happening to you, disasters happening to you, your mental state can improve constantly. Your state of happiness can grow constantly. That's something you can control. But you can't control the events that happen to you. And you know, Dalai Lama gets chased out of Tibet. It happens to us. Okay.
The Dalai Lama can just come up with it, and I can just start to at the same time. How can we do that and still have this course be what it was tonight?
It's in our homework.
Isn't it in class?
Homework.
The idea of God, if you say that God is the principle of karma, and if you behave as if God were the principle of karma, and I mean a good Christian does, and a good Jew does. I mean a good Christian is behaving exactly, he thinks he's doing it in the presence of God. We think we're doing it in the presence of the principle of karma. I'm not sure they act much different. But I think in the end you must... In the end it's an obstacle. You don't understand that everything comes exactly from your actions. I think it's a huge obstacle that might actually prevent you from reaching your goal. If you don't truly believe that every bad thing that happens to you is directly related to something you've done. And that if you do any bad reaction to it, any bad, if you're just irritated slightly, you're going to have a bad reaction. Much less fight with a person, or yell, or get angry, or get red. You know, anything less than equanimity is dangerous for you and harmful to you. And will have bad results, must have bad results. I think when you really understand that, but it forces you to be is happy. it forces you to be happy in the face of bad circumstances and bad people. And that's, even if Buddhism is wrong, that's still a great feeling. Try it. You know, it's very interesting. And that's not why you do it. You don't do it to be calm, or you do it to get out of suffering. But by the way, it's also the nicest thing to do. And by the way, it's the most pleasant thing to do. And it's the best thing for the situation. You know, if you're just happy, the person's screwing you and you're happy. You know, that's a great... you can do it. As you study more, you can do it. If you have somebody literally trying to mess you up, you're just not going to allow them to ruin your happiness.
Dishonesty.
No, it's not even talking about his reaction. You're just happy. In fact, you're always happy.
As distinguished between somebody who's just plain crazy and is happy. There's a big difference, right? It's not the same.
Sanshi Bhagi Jushin Eto Jham Vira Vinci Nende Yampadi Sanghe Shindu
Gewa di Gewa.
This is the end of Class 5.